This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Around the world today, people are sharing the same preoccupation, trying to figure out what's going on in the Soviet Union now that Gorbachev is out and the hardliners are in. To help us understand the events behind the coup, we called Robert Cullen. He writes about the Soviet Union for The Atlantic and The New Yorker. He was last there in June researching an article on the Soviet military. He's also written a book on the crumbling Soviet empire that's scheduled for publication in October. We called Cullen earlier today, and he told me that this coup was the worst news he could imagine from the Soviet Union.
I think that there is still hope, however, and I look forward to the next few days with great anticipation because I have the sense that this coup may not work, that the people may rise up against it, and that the average Russian soldier is not going to fire at them.
What would it take for the Russian people to rise up against this coup successfully?
Well, I think you'd have to have massive street demonstrations and a general strike, and either or both is possible. That's what Boris Yeltsin has called for, and one of the things that I find difficult to understand is why the people who brought this coup off did not have the foresight, apparently, to arrest him in his home before he could take an active role in opposing their coup. But they didn't. It suggests that maybe they are overconfident, or maybe their forces are not as large or as well organized as they might want us to believe. And therefore, Yeltsin still is at large and still able to serve as a rallying point for opposition to the coup. And I think he'll try to do that.
Do you think you'll maybe wake up tomorrow morning and find out Yeltsin has been arrested?
It's quite possible. That's certainly, if I were running the coup, that would be the first item on my list, is get him out of circulation, because he's the only politician in the Soviet Union within Russia with a valid claim on popular legitimacy. And if he's allowed to remain at large and allowed to organize opposition, I think it's quite possible that you could see not only people out on the streets, but severe divisions within the army. It's quite worth noting, I think, that in June, when the Russian Republic held its presidential election, the high command of the army, which is known in Russian as the Verkhushka, openly supported Nikolai Ryzhkov, who was the old prime minister under Gorbachev, and Boris Gromov, who was a hardline general, the last Soviet officer in Afghanistan, and now is the deputy minister of internal affairs, a position that gives him command over the internal affairs troops in the country. And those people did not even get a majority of support within the army. The bulk of the officer corps voted for Yeltsin and his running mate, Colonel Alexander Rutskoy, who is in fact an Afghan war hero who has joined a growing movement of officers toward the democratic side of the Soviet political spectrum. And if Yeltsin can set himself up as a standard to rally around, I think a fair number of the officers in the Soviet Army, particularly the junior officers and middle-ranking officers, might well be tempted to join him.
Can you tell how much military support there is for the coup and how much communication there was between the leaders of the coup and the military there was before the coup actually happened?
Well, it's impossible to know at the moment. It would be very interesting if we could get some information, which so far I have not seen, about which particular units are involved in the takeover of key government buildings and so forth in Moscow. My suspicion is that these are elite units, of which there are a relatively small number in the Soviet Army, and that they have not asked the rank-and-file conscripts to take part in this operation as yet.
Because they're afraid of the alienation they might feel?
Because they can't trust that the rank-and-file conscripts are going to shoot in this kind of a situation. For one thing, a fairly significant percentage of them come from non-Russian republics and probably see this coup correctly as an effort to prevent their own republics from ever gaining any kind of independence from Moscow. And for another, the young people in the country have, I think, as much as anybody else, been changed by Glasnost and are not the kind of young people anymore who will blindly follow communist leadership, so that rank-and-file draftees, I don't think, are going to be reliable forces for the army in the days ahead. They're going to rely initially on elite units, which have been picked, if for nothing else, for their fluency in the Russian language, which tends to eliminate a lot of the non-Russian nationalities, and have been indoctrinated to believe that they are doing the right thing. How long that indoctrination will hold if babushki are coming up to them in the streets and berating them for betraying their mothers and fathers is another question. I was in Romania shortly after the coup in December 1989, which removed Nicolae Ceausescu, and it was apparent then that the key element was that when Ceausescu had to call on the draftees to fire in his behalf, they wouldn't fire.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Robert Cullen, and he's a Soviet expert who's written extensively about the Soviet Union for The New Yorker and The Atlantic magazines, and he's the author of a forthcoming book called Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. Gorbachev had lost popular support before the coup. Do you think that there might be a surprising amount of support for the coup because it got rid of Gorbachev?
Well, I asked that question in Moscow in June at the All-Union Center for Public Opinion Research, and it is exactly correct that Gorbachev had miserable public support ratings, 7% in the latest poll that they had taken. But they had also asked people about their attitudes toward the army and about their attitudes toward a military coup. Support for the army as an institution had been dropping steadily since April 89, when the army intervened in a demonstration in Tbilisi and killed a number of Georgians. And it had dropped to about 35% of the population being willing to say that they trusted the army. They asked whether the people would support a military coup, and a very small minority said that they would immediately support a military coup, about 14 or 15%. Another 10 or 15% said that they might, at some point in the future, support a military coup. The rest of the people that were asked were resolutely opposed to it. So I think you're seeing that a minority of the population might support this coup. Certainly a very tiny minority within the intellectual community, principally the extreme Russian nationalists. No one of any consequence, I don't think, in any of the republics outside of the party nomenclatura. So I think you're going to find that the new leaders of the Kremlin may have trouble extending their writ much past Moscow's city limits.
The coup happened one day before the Union Treaty that would have given more autonomy to the Soviet republics. You've been studying the Soviet republics and their independence movements. What would this treaty have accomplished?
Well, it's not clear because the treaty itself was a little ambiguous, and I would think that the fact that it took place a day before that treaty was to be signed may not have been as significant as the fact that it took place in August, which is the month when Soviet leaders traditionally take their vacation in the Crimea, and not coincidentally the month when Nikita Khrushchev was overthrown. But the Union Treaty would have given a significant amount of the power of the purse over to the republic governments. The government was supposed to be structured in such a way that the republics would have the power to tax, and they would then remit a certain percentage of their tax revenues to the central government. To be honest, I thought that the Union Treaty was a recipe for financial chaos, because I can't conceive of a situation where the republic governments will get together and agree on a fiscally sound central policy that would prevent inflation and prevent the ruinous printing of currency that has already begun in the Soviet Union. And I think the military saw that as a direct threat to its ability to command resources and maintain its force levels at a number that the high command considers reasonable, which is a lot higher than the reformers in the republics think.
What do you think the coup will mean for the future of the independence movements?
Well, for the immediate future, unless the coup is reversed, I think that one of the first items on the agenda of the military government will be to suppress those movements. One of the things that remains to be seen is whether they can do that in a place like Georgia or Armenia, where the population is well-armed and prepared to resist. But clearly, I think the military wants to suppress those independence movements and will try to do so. In the long run, I don't think that can happen. But in the short run, I think you can certainly expect to see some arrests, probably, unfortunately, some bloodshed.
What do you think the coup is going to mean for the START Treaty and for the Middle East Peace Conference, which the Soviet Union had agreed to co-host with the United States.
Well, until it becomes more clear how successful this coup will be and what the policies of the new government will be, I think that it would be impossible to make any predictions about what's going to happen in Soviet international policy. Obviously, there are some severe potential problems. There are troops that have yet to withdraw from Germany, troops that have yet to withdraw from Poland, and so on. And what happens to those troops is going to be of prime concern, I think, in the next 6 months. My guess would be that the START Treaty will face a much more difficult time in the Senate if we're looking at a Soviet Union that appears possibly going back to the kinds of policies that prevailed under Brezhnev. But it might go through if the new government suggests that it's likely to continue to try to follow the same basic line Gorbachev had. I don't think you'll see any improvement in economics. The trade agreement, which President Bush just sent up to the Congress a couple of weeks ago, is dead in the water as far as normal tariffs for the Soviet Union and so on are concerned. I think the peace conference is also going to be dead in the water. It's such a touchy thing that I can't imagine the United States being interested in anything that would allow this new government, assuming it stays in power, to have a major role in the Middle East. And I can't imagine that the Israelis will feel very confident about going forward under this new government.
What are you looking to President Bush to do right now?
I think that there's one obvious thing that he can do, and that is to make it very clear to the men who have taken power in Moscow that they will get no economic cooperation from the West as long as they continue to try to resist a legitimate government. Either they return Gorbachev to power or they have elections where Yeltsin and other people can freely vie for power, or they face the prospect of getting no aid. And I don't think they can survive under those circumstances indefinitely. Their credit is totally used up in the West. They can't get any loans from Western banks without government backing. And unless they get those loans for grain, for industrial equipment and so forth, their chances of reviving the Soviet economy are basically nil, because they are not going to have enough popular support to get people to work enthusiastically at their present jobs. And I think that they're going to realize that, and in the long run, that's going to be very important in their calculations. So I think that it's important. If I were advising President Bush, what I would do would be to tell him that he should get, as I think he's probably going to do, this is an obvious step, it doesn't take a genius to figure it out, he should get Cole, Mitterrand, Major, and the Japanese and so forth together and issue a joint statement, basically cutting the Soviets off as long as this government is in power. No credits, no aid, no help whatsoever. And I think that would put a fair amount of pressure on the coup leadership to do something to regain some legitimacy in the eyes of the West. They're in a very weak position in the Soviet Union right now. Their credit is gone. They can't borrow money on their own. And they're not well placed to run the country indefinitely without outside assistance.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Robert Cullen, author of the forthcoming book, October Twilight of Empire Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc, and he's been writing for years about the Soviet Union. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the coup in the Soviet Union. My guest Robert Cullen writes extensively about the Soviet Union, and his recent articles have appeared in The New Yorker and The Atlantic magazines. Is this the end of the end of the Cold War? Do you think that this indicates the Cold War might start again?
In the short run, possibly. In the long run, no. The only real precedent for what's going on here, I think, is probably what happened in Poland in 1981 when General Jaruzelski took power and tried to banish Solidarity. And it was a losing battle in the long run, even though in the short run he did manage to put Lech Wałęsa and a number of people in jail. In the long run, he could not survive without popular support and without the Soviets being willing to prop him up. He realized that and turned over power to Solidarity in a peaceful process. And I think that the same will be true of these people. They cannot survive indefinitely without some kind of support, and nobody in the Soviet Union anymore believes that they have any answers to the problems that the country has. So I think that within a period of time that's difficult to predict, but maybe as short as 6 months or a year, maybe a few weeks, that their time will pass. And while I would not rule out anything at the moment, I think that in the medium term at least, the democratic forces will regain the initiative and try to put the country back on the path that it was following, however fitfully, under Gorbachev's leadership. What happens to Gorbachev is anybody's guess. Obviously, they have it in their power to kill him. It doesn't appear that they've done so at this point. They would lose a tremendous amount if they did kill him, because his death would no doubt stigmatize them forever in the minds of other world leaders and in world opinion, and make the Soviet Union a pariah state as long as they were in command. I think that they understand that, and for that reason they will try to keep Gorbachev under house arrest until they've established some semblance of order. They'll probably try to do some things to rally some popular support. They might, for example, put on trial some people who they will accuse of speculating in scarce goods and so forth, who will serve as scapegoats for the economic problems, and they will try to, through an infusion of discipline and so forth, give a little boost to production. If there are any stores of grain and food somewhere that the government has hidden away, I'm sure they'll appear at the right time on the store shelves. But I don't think that in the long run, any longer, people are prepared to believe that these people have the answer. One of the things that Glasnost has done over the last 5 years has been to change a lot of the opinions of people in the Soviet Union. When I was in Moscow in June, I talked to a member of the parliament, a colonel in the Air Force, a test pilot, one of the top test pilots in the Air Force, the kind of man that you would expect to be a conservative based on the way test pilots normally are in most countries. And he told me that his whole way of thinking had changed a little bit after he read 1984, which was published finally in the Soviet Union a couple of years ago. You can't make that man unread that book. The ideas that he has picked up from the period of Glasnost are in his head, and they're not going anywhere. And as long as that's the case, I think that there's a good chance that people of goodwill will triumph in the end. Excuse me, I'm getting a little caught up in what I'm saying. It's a terrible thing that's going on over there.
You have a lot of friends in the Soviet Union, and you're wondering about them now?
Yes. I think they'll all be safe. At least I hope so. It's hard to say. I'm hoping that these people will attempt to do this, as I said, as nonviolently as possible, as rationally as possible, and that they'll realize after a while that the people don't support them and that they can't go on without popular support. But it's anybody's guess as to what can happen.
You know, something I think a lot of American journalists must be thinking about now is what happens to all of the sources who they've quoted in the past few years, the men and women who were so openly supporting the reforms of the past few years. You know, might there be a crackdown against them now? Might they have to pay consequences for having spoken as they did?
It's certainly possible. But again, there may be some safety in numbers. For the average person who has been quoted, they must have files hundreds of feet thick of people of that type who have said something negative about the old regime or the security forces. I suspect that their ability to take reprisals against people will be limited to people like Yeltsin and President Landsbergis in Lithuania and so on, who have been the leaders of the anti-central government movement, and to people like former Foreign Minister Shevardnadze, who I think is roundly hated by the military for some of the agreements that he made while he was Foreign Minister. Those are the people at risk right now. It would be a true nightmare if it got to the point that the average person whom I know, or people who spoke to us, journalists, were in jeopardy. But it's impossible to say that that won't happen. I just don't think that it will.
Now, what's your story now? You're trying to get back into the Soviet Union?
Well, I'd like to go as soon as I can. I'm applying for a visa today, and I'll see what happens. But I'm hopeful that the military's control of the government is not such yet that they control the foreign ministry and the in-tourist agency that issue the visas. It may be that if I move fast, I'll be able to get in there before they can establish control over those kinds of agencies.
So that's a real concern, that if you don't move fast enough, it might be really difficult to get in.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's the best case scenario? How soon would you be going?
Thursday.
Wow.
Under any circumstances, it takes the Soviet bureaucracy that long to process a visa request. So that's when I've made a reservation, and that's when I'm hoping to get a visa.
Robert Cullen, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with your plans to get back into the Soviet Union.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Robert Cullen is the author of the forthcoming book, Twilight of Empire, Inside the Crumbling Soviet Bloc. He spoke to us earlier today from his home outside Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.